You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Stuart Butler. I'm a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution, and I want to welcome you all to Brookings and to those on the webcast for this discussion on the policy and prospects of budget process reform. And we're pleased to be co-hosting this event with the National Academy of Public Administration, or NAPA. I just want to remind everybody here that the event is being webcast, so if you'll just take a moment right now to turn off or silence your phones, that would be very, very helpful. The budget process may seem rather arcane to lots of people, I'm sure it does, but it's critically important to the functioning of our government. Developing a budget in an orderly and timely manner to advance national priorities is a basic function of government. Unfortunately, we've not been very good at carrying out that basic function in the United States. We're increasingly unable in our budgeting to meet deadlines. We've missed deadlines, which of course impose enormous costs and anxiety to many people who are dependent upon government and to businesses and to organizations that require government support. We seem to move from crisis to crisis and to deadlock. That's undermined confidence in the government itself. And we've been unable to really address the very basic deep-seated issues in this country that require looking at budgets and changing budgets. I think it's fair to say that this inability to function in this way has contributed to the distrust of government. We've seen over many years a steady decline in the confidence among Americans that the government in Washington will actually function and do the right thing. And of course, it's come to a head in many ways in this election. So I think the failure to actually operate a budget, to develop and design and carry out a budget, is one of the big factors in the deepening distrust of government. Well, over the last 2 years, here at Brookings, we've hosted a series of monthly meetings and roundtables to discuss the budget process reform ideas. We've brought together budget experts. We've brought together also political scientists in these discussions. The people who've come to these roundtables, the roundtable group, is bipartisan. It represents organizations on the left and the right. It includes former officials of the federal government, people who've been very much in the front of the whole budget issue. Including many members of the National Academy of Public Administration have taken part. And many of the organizations that around those tables have been in the forefront of developing ideas to try to deal with the budget process problems that we have. And in fact, you can see both outside in terms of some of the publications, but also on a website devoted to the budget roundtable called budgetingroundtable.com. You can go on that website and see a number of the papers that we've developed. But it isn't just a question of looking at budget process proposals for reform, but the roundtable has also discussed some of the insights and experiences from political science to suggest ways to actually achieve reform. It's all well and good to have a set of proposals for reform, but one has to spend just as much time thinking about how can we nudge or encourage the political process to actually deliver those reforms. And much of our conversation in the roundtable has been about precisely that. And we'll be hearing more about that this morning. Today we'll be hearing from two panels reflecting on these conversations and other conversations around town about budget process reform. The first panel will describe some of the leading ideas that have been developed in this area. The second panel will bring together a group of veteran budget experts and political scientists to discuss a little further some of these proposals, but also, more importantly, to discuss the experiences and insights from political science that should affect the way we think about the process of reform and the prospects for that in the coming months and years. And now, to describe the work of the National Academy of Public Administration in this area and to moderate the first panel, let me hand over to my co-host, Dan Blair, who's president and CEO of NAPA.
Thank you, Stuart, for that warm introduction. I'm glad to be here this morning with this august group of budgeteers to discuss strategies and scenarios for successfully reforming the federal budget process. I'm Dan Blair, President and CEO of the National Academy of Public Administration, a congressionally chartered policy institute charged by Congress at advising leaders at the federal, state, and local levels on issues of public administration and governance. The Academy is made up of soon to be 850-plus fellows who range in the public administration spectrum, with the common thread that all are noted for their significant and substantial contributions to the field of public administration. Today, we have a number of fellows present, both on the panels and in the audience, and we also have fellows watching through the live streaming feed. Stuart, I want to thank you and the Brookings Institution for hosting this important conference this morning. As with many aspects of our federal government, our budget processes are in need of updating and reform. For multiple reasons, the 1974 Budget Act seems to have transitioned from a rule to an often ignored suggestion. There seems to be agreement we need a more disciplined and realistic process, but identifying what exactly those new processes should be remains the challenge. Today, we have an opportunity to hear from some of our country's leading budget policy experts, and it's my privilege to introduce to you today and moderate the first panel. Joining me today on this first panel are noted budgeteers Dr. Phil Joyce and Dr. Steve Redburn. Let me briefly give you their bios. Many of you know them in the audience, and they are well known in this community. Phil Joyce serves as a senior associate dean and a professor of public policy in the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. Professor Joyce's teaching and research interests include public budgeting, performance measurement, and intergovernmental relations. Phil is the editor of Public Budgeting and Finance and is a past president of the American Association of Budget and Program Analysis and past chair of the ASPA Center on Accountability and Performance. In addition to his work at the University of Maryland, Phil has been on the faculty of the George Washington University, the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse, and the University of Kentucky. Dr. Joyce has 12 years of public sector work experience, including 4 years with the Illinois Bureau of the Budget and 5 years with the United States CBO. In 1992, he received the CBO Director's Award for Distinguished Service, and Phil has received his PhD from the Maxwell School, his MPA from Penn State, and his BA from Teal College. Did I correct that?
Excellent.
Thank you. And importantly, Dr. Joyce is a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. To Phil's right is Dr. Steve Redburn. He's a distinguished lecturer, budget advisor, and authority on fiscal management and government performance with over 25 years of experience as a senior government official at OMB and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Following his retirement from government service, Dr. Redburn has continued his pursuit of budget policy through serving as a lecturer at GW. He's the director of fiscal studies for the Centers on the Public Service and an affiliated member of the School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs of George Mason. And in that role, he helps lead research on the federal government's budget processes with other members of the National Budgeting Roundtable. He also served as a project director for the Peterson Pugh Commission on Budget Reform, where he supervised preparation of the commission's report and comprehensive reform of the federal government budget process. Dr. Redburn formerly served as a scholar and study director at the National Academies of Sciences, where he directed a study in conjunction with NAPA of the fiscal futures of the U.S. Steve is a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. He serves on its board and is a member of its executive committee, and he also serves as the board's treasurer. And with that, we will proceed to our moderated discussion.
I'd like to go first with your presentation.
So I've been involved in enough conversations about reforming the federal budget process now to begin to observe certain patterns. Many of them fall into one of two patterns. Many of them start with the lament that the current process is broken, and then they there's a litany of evidence for that, the failure to pass the budget resolution on a regular basis or the to observe other opportunities, to take advantage of other opportunities that are inherent in the Congressional Budget Act, the failure, of course, to pass appropriations by the beginning of the fiscal year in reliance on continuing resolutions, and most years recently an omnibus that rolls up the remaining appropriations. Games of chicken about the raising of the debt ceiling and about enacting a continuing resolution or keeping the government that would keep the government open. So there's a litany of evidence of that sort. And that leads to discussions about reforms that would help restore some order, perhaps return to some imagined regular order of the budget process, or at least make the task simpler, more streamlined, and therefore easier to finish. So we have proposals, for example, for biennial budgeting, which would, at a minimum, cut the number of missed deadlines in half, and proposals for automatic CRs or for automatic increases in the debt ceiling and other simplifications of the rules, making it harder to filibuster individual appropriations bills and so on. So that's one kind of conversation. There's another conversation that starts by asking the question, what is the budget process that the nation, a nation like the United States, needs to deal with its complex interlocking challenges, to look forward long-term and sustain the commitments that it has made and manages its resources effectively to address many, many growing list always of demands on the federal government for action and responsibility. Paul Posner and I, and a memo that we've drafted for a presidential transition project that is a joint project of NAPA and the American Society of Public Administration, start in that place. That is, what kind of budget process do we need? What would be its characteristics? And imagine what that endpoint might look like for reform, and then recognize at the same time that it's going to take a while to get there, if we ever get there. By the way, this memo is going to be is one of a set of 24 that's going to be published next month by that project, addressing different dimensions of the governance challenge facing the country. So we have listed in our memo that you have available here today a set of characteristics of a good budget process for the federal government, one that is we think should be more disciplined, predictable, and institutionalized, that facilitates negotiation and compromise, that regularly reviews all elements of the budget, including revenues and spending, that is more forward-looking, giving greater attention both to growth-producing investments and to long-term commitments, that supports stabilizing the debt at a safe level over the far horizon. In other words, that encourages decisions that produce a sustainable fiscal outlook, but at the same time is neutral with regard to specific policy choices. The process should not be biased toward a particular set of policies, including levels and balance between revenues and spending. And finally, a process that makes more use of evidence, systematic evidence, of how alternative resource uses would improve the government's performance in achieving national goals. So in recognizing that we're not going to get to that kind of a process immediately, it probably take many years, and it's not the work of a single administration in Congress. We have some proposals for the new president in Congress to consider, some steps that could be taken in that direction. And one of these is to budget for national goals, to make room in the process annually for considering a small number, maybe a handful, of major national policy objectives and doing a deeper analysis of those. Inevitably and necessarily, the process is always going to be primarily focused incrementally on marginal choices. That is, should we increase spending for this program? Should we cut that program? Should we tweak this or that policy? The process is also going to be, for the most part, as it is now, somewhat myopic, looking primarily at the next year, the budget year, rather than farther ahead. And it's it's going to be stovepiped or siloed. That is, that is, it's organized, the decision-making is organized by agencies, departments, and their programs for the most part. And it's also siloed in the sense that decision-making about revenue policy, tax policy, is separated in the process from decisions about spending. But we propose to make room in the process for a deeper analysis, as I've said, of current federal policies for a few major national policy goals each year. And if there's time later in the Q&A, maybe we can talk more about how this would work in detail. But the idea is, in a nutshell, to identify a portfolio of policies that includes both spending and tax expenditures, as spending through the tax code, and regulations and other policies that are associated with each of these major policy goals that tend to cut across agency jurisdictions, committee jurisdictions, and Congress. And then to through the work of the Budget Committee and the Budget Resolution, direct GAO, CBO, others to analyze these portfolios, and which constitute essentially the implicit strategy of the federal government today to try to achieve a given policy objective, in comparison to alternative strategies that might help us identify breakthrough gains in productivity and the use of resources for achieving that goal, and might also identify budget savings. So that's the idea, is to make room in the process then for portfolio analysis and deeper analysis that would lead to recommendations in the budget resolution in the following cycle for review and decisions about that policy area. So a second set of recommendations has to do with the budget committees. Introducing this kind of an approach into the current process would imply stronger role for the budget committees. I'm not going to say much about this because Phil has written about this and is going to talk about it. but we see them providing leadership and direction, shaping this and working through the budget resolution and reconciliation to help make it happen. Third, we recommend establishing a multi-year framework and process for the budget with targets for revenues and spending and for budget savings. This has become the norm in Europe and other and around the world, really, to have multi-year framework within which annual budgeting is done. And again, Phil has written extensively about this, and I'm going to defer to him, let him talk about that when he gets the mic. The fourth step that we recommend is to regularly review and budget for tax expenditures and mandatory programs, which are now sometimes said on autopilot, to make them subject to regular, if not annual, review, and to require such reviews in the budget resolution to develop more evidence about the effectiveness of tax expenditures that could be brought to bear in this kind of analysis, including the portfolio reviews, and to consider adding the totals for tax expenditures to both the revenue and spending sides of the budget to provide a more accurate presentation of the true scale of the budget. The revenue losses from tax expenditures annually are roughly equal to those to the spending through appropriated programs. So this would raise both revenues and spending by equal amounts and without changing the deficit calculation. And that would certainly highlight the need to give them more attention. And we propose for mandatory programs a regular process of review that includes setting longer-term caps or targets, which would, if they were not met, require Congress to take some action to address that overage. So that's part of that recommendation. And then finally, we propose a review and revisiting of budget concepts. The last time there was a full review of the basic concepts that are used in the budget process and how they are applied was in the 1967, when the President's Commission gave us the set of budget concepts that we largely adhere to today. But there's a long list of potential issues and agenda for a commission that of the Congress and the President, perhaps together, to take a fresh look at the scope of the budget, how we define spending and revenues, and many other issues that seem like they're dry and technical but can have major impacts on the way the decision-making process is framed and set up. And Rudy Penner and Barry Anderson have written for the National Budgeting Roundtable about this, and you can read their paper if you want to get an idea of what the agenda of such a commission might be. So those are some steps that we think would help us move the nation toward a process that would better serve its needs.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, Steve. Good morning. I'm very happy to be here. I've been following more earnestly, perhaps, than many budget reform ideas for about the last 25 years. In fact, when I was at CBO in the first part of the 1990s, it was actually my job. I was introduced once to an external visitor by one of our macroeconomists and who said, "This is Phil Joyce. He follows the budget process. We're glad he does, because otherwise we would have to." So there's a lot of these reform ideas that we're talking about that have been around for a while. There are some that are relatively new, but there's a reason I think that we've been focusing a lot on budget process reform in the last couple years, and I'll get to that later. But first, I want to talk about the ideas themselves, and start out by talking about these two reform ideas that Steve alluded to that I've been doing some work on. And second, talk explicitly about the activities of the House and the Senate, where both of the budget committees have been focusing in quite a lot of depth on budget process reform in the last year. So first, to a couple of reform ideas I've been focused on. The first that I've been talking about and writing about for about 10 years is really focused on strengthening the budget committees. And the reason I think that this is important is you have to go back to the original aims of the 1974 Budget Act. And frankly, I think there were two big ideas in the 1974 Budget Act. One big idea was CBO. And the other big idea was the budget resolution, because the budget resolution was the key vehicle through which the Congress was to articulate its priorities. And in fact, in order to do what Steve just suggested, which is to focus more explicitly on entitlement spending, tax expenditures, really at this point the budget resolution is the main vehicle through which that would happen. And the notion here I think is powerful, which is that in the absence of an articulation of an overall fiscal policy, congressional budgeting is simply the accidental and haphazard result of whatever laws happen to pass in a given year. And here, I think the budget committees used to be quite influential. When you think back to people like Pete Domenici and Leon Panetta, they were powerful members of Congress and they helped to shape national fiscal policy. But the budget committees, I think, have been weakened in recent years, and this is in no small part due to the fact that the budget resolution has become a sort of hit-and-miss proposition. In fact, over the past 16 years, including this one, we've only even passed a budget resolution seven times. The budget resolution, as you know, is supposed to be agreed to by the House and the Senate. Now, in many years, that's because the House passed one and the Senate either did not or there could not be an agreement reached between the House and the Senate. But this year, in fact, both the House and the Senate failed to pass a budget resolution. And as near as I can tell, it's the first time in history that the House didn't pass a budget resolution. So my notion here is that the budget committees would be stronger and taken more seriously if they explicitly included members of the congressional leadership. This is an idea that's actually been around since the late 1980s, when former Senator Nancy Kassebaum suggested something similar to this. I would rename the committees on national priorities, and I would include the chairs and ranking members of major committees in the House and Senate. And ideally, I think this would be part of a larger reform of the committee structure, and I would go as far as to say that we might consider combining the Authorization and Appropriations Committees. But even if that's not going to happen, and it's probably not, I think reform of the budget committees themselves might be possible. Second, as Steve suggested, I've been focused on encouraging a longer-term approach to budgeting. There's no question that the problems that we face are long-term in nature, and therefore they require long-term solutions. And in fact, again, as Steve suggested, it's a budgeting best practice internationally to think about policy not in single-year terms, but across multiple years. Despite the fact that the federal government is the largest and most complex institution, I would say, in the world, Not only does it not focus on multiple years in its budget process, it doesn't even do annual budgeting well. So I would say, you know, a step in this direction would be actually to do an annual budget and do it on time, but let's go beyond that and start to think more specifically about some ideas that might focus more on the long term. And these include an explicit focus on fiscal rules and targets, greater attention in the president's budget and congressional budgeting on the multi-year effect of policies, and encouraging the public and the press to focus on the long term as opposed to perhaps the deficit number in a single year. The ideas that we presented so far, Steve and myself, are ones that largely came out of the NAPA project or the budgeting roundtable. But these two organizations are not alone in seriously considering budget process reform. Organizations like the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, the Bipartisan Policy Center, have also engaged in budget reform efforts. Now, in all of these cases, what they have in common is that lots of the usual suspects, and by this I mean academic budget experts or people who've occupied high-level budgeting positions, are the people who have been involved in in these conversations, and frankly, I see many of them in the room. but I have to say that all of these are serious efforts, but it's not unusual for people like us, and when I say people like us, I of course mean budget geeks, to talk about budget process reform. What is more unusual is the level of attention that budget reform has gotten in the Congress this year, largely through the substantial public record compiled by the House and Senate Budget Committees. Since late July of 2015, the House Budget Committee has held, by my count, 8 hearings featuring 29 witnesses on budget process reform. And the topics discussed have included first principles of budget reform, restoring the congressional power of the purse, biennial budgeting, controlling mandatory budgeting, fiscal goals, budget enforcement. I could go on. At the conclusion of this, the committee articulated 5 principles of budget reform. 1, exercise constitutional government. 2, promote and sustain fiscal responsibility. 3, restore congressional control of spending and taxation. 4, improve oversight and facilitate orderly decision making. And 5, reflect the true cost of programs. And I would submit that while people might disagree about the specific definition of each one of these things, many people who would focus on budget process reform would agree with these principles. In fact, Chairman Price has pledged a total rewrite of the 1974 Budget Act, and the committee, and I would encourage you to go to their website, has published a number of thoughtful papers summarizing current challenges and presenting reform ideas. The Senate has also been busy. Chairman Enzi and the Senate Budget Committee, in a 6-month period commencing in October of 2015, also held 8 hearings, and those hearings featured 25 witnesses and focused on many of the same issues that were addressed by the House: biennial budgeting, regulatory budgeting, budget control. A June 2016 document, which I also commend to you, summarized without specifically endorsing lots of ideas coming out of these hearings. Some of these are ones that we've already discussed: Budget Concepts Commission, focusing on tax expenditures, for example. But there are many others, and I'll just list them but not elaborate on them, just to give you an idea of the scope of the ideas that are being considered. Making the budget resolution a law requiring the president's signature. Again, creating a biennial budget process. Ending Voterama, which, for those of you who know about the Senate, is a meaningless exercise in the Senate where senators consider amendments to the budget resolution pretending that they're making policy when they're really just scoring political points. Addressing the chronic problem of late appropriations, either by imposing consequences for them or by providing for automatic continuing resolutions. Creating a capital budget. Eliminating baseline budgeting and reforming how we budget for disasters. This is only a partial list. There were more in this memo. So finally, why all this attention to budget reform? I think there are 2 main reasons. First, there is the reasonable consensus that budget outcomes, whether we are talking about procedural outcomes or substantive outcomes, are a mess. Faced with this reality, it's easy to blame the process. I won't go into detail on this except to say that it's been my observation over many years that it's easier to identify problems than it is to devise solutions. In fact, the fact that there are a lot of problems with the budget process does not necessarily mean that the next idea that any of us have might be the solution. So I think it's important to be careful that we don't do more harm than good. Second, I think there is a good explanation for all this congressional attention to budget reform. I think it became clear to both the House and Senate budget committees that they were not going to be able to pass a budget resolution this year. And faced with that reality, there were two options. One option was to close up shop for the year. A second option was to figure out how to productively use the time. I certainly don't fault the budget committees. In fact, I commend them for using the time that was available to them to focus on budget reform. And while some of us may not, and I do not, agree with more or some of these ideas, it's undeniable that both the House and Senate have made serious efforts at collecting and analyzing budget reform ideas, and that there might be payoff from this later on if and when the moon and the stars align for budget reform. The problem at that point will be taking this laundry list, figuring out which ones would genuinely represent improvements, and then working to get the political system to accept these ideas. And certainly that's something we'll be hearing about in the second panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil, and thank you, Steve. Why don't we start off with a question for the panel up here, and then we'll go to the audience and engage the audience. Both are honing in on Congress. Congress is also within the executive branch. You'll need what makes next year
next year will be the first time that under the GPRA Modernization Act, the agency, executive agency's processes of developing new strategic plans and strategic objectives will be synchronized with the electoral presidential election cycle. So there will be an opportunity for Congress and the President to use that that work to set an agenda for major policy reviews such as we talked about under the heading of portfolio budgeting. So I could imagine next year a new president, presidential administration at a high level consulting with Congress about what the major policy priorities might be, not with the idea that they're going to agree on solutions, but that they might want to identify policy problems that are ripe for analysis. At a lower level, GPRA requires agencies to consult with Congress as they develop their strategic objectives, and that is something that has not been well organized, but the budget committees could help organize that process. So in other words, GPRA has given an opportunity to Congress and the administration to focus on major policy goals and how to achieve them and to build that into the budget process. Or you could imagine that the leaders of the House and the Senate on their own initiative could, and working through the budget committees, could select some targets for in-depth review. And then if that is done over the first year of new administration, in this, and they might also draw on the work of GAO, by the way, on fragmented, overlapping, duplicative programs in selecting those policy areas for review. If those reviews are conducted in over the next few months, perhaps with the help of CBO and GAO to do the analysis, or with the help of a congressionally chartered organization like NAPA, for example, to convene a panel, then the fruits of that could be used to inform the budget resolution for fiscal year 2019, which would be the first full-fledged budget on the regular timetable for the new administration. So that's one way I could imagine this unfolding. And then the budget resolution could implement the findings of those reviews.
Phil, did you want to comment on that?
I would just add a couple things. I would say first, to talk about the elephant in the room, it may matter who the president is, but leaving that aside, I think that history would tell us that there's more chance of things happening in terms of sort of legislative efforts in odd-numbered years than even-numbered years, and that the first year of a new presidential administration is often, because it's a further distance away from the next election, is often a good time, to focus on these things. Now, having said that, political polarization is a real thing. And so we shouldn't sugarcoat it. I'll leave this to the second panel, but I think we should not imply that this is going to be an easy thing to do, because all reforms, whether they're policy reforms or process reforms, inevitably create winners and losers. And so there will be calculations in terms of who is in which camp.
Why don't we go to the audience at this point? We have two mobile mics. Ali over here, back there. So questions from the audience. If you have a question and you're recognized, please identify yourself. And
morning, I'm Stan Collender. I write for Forbes. I teach at Georgetown, and I'm a longtime observer on the budget process. Phil, I'm going to direct my comments at you, but you're both welcome to address them. And they're going to be a little strong, and I apologize. All right. I'm astounded at what I think is, I'm going to call, academic naivete. You gave great credit to the budget committees for holding hearings on a budget process that they refused to implement. What makes you think that any new rules would be any more interested in implementing new rules than they are in the existing rules? Or why don't you give credit to the fact that they could do whatever you wanted them to now? They've got all the power they want. They just refuse to do it. So what makes you think that process changes of any kind are going to get this Congress or the next Congress or the Congress after that to do something they don't want to do?
Well, let me start by saying that I think you know, because you and I sat next to each other and testified before the House Budget Committee, that it is my view that the problem that we have is not primarily a problem with the budget process. That is, I think we have a larger political problem, and I think the budget process, people who think that this is about a failure of the budget process are, I think, focused on the wrong thing. In fact, I testified a few years ago with Jim Nussle, the former chair of the Budget Committee, Republican chair of the Budget Committee, and his advice to the House Budget Committee was, before you decide the budget process is broken, you might want to try it. My view is not that they couldn't pass a budget resolution if they wanted to, or that even there's a sort of fundamental problem with the structure of the budget process. I think the budget resolution is actually quite a useful device when it is used effectively. All I'm saying is that I think that it seems quite likely to me that the failure to pass a budget resolution this year was beyond the control of the budget committees themselves. And so given that they could not control whether the House could pass a budget resolution and in the Senate, whether the Senate could pass a budget resolution, that, you know, deciding to just sort of not do anything at all was an inferior choice to me to thinking about how the budget process might be changed. Would I think it was better if they had actually passed a budget resolution? Yes, I would think it was better. It seemed clear that that was not going to happen. And so given that that was not going to happen, how might they have productively used their time? I think they used their time quite productively under the assumption that the most productive use of their time would be to actually operate the budget process. It's been my observation that when the Congress and the President are actually focused on budget policy, they don't talk about the budget process. They only talk about budget process reform when they're not really focused on the budget process, using the budget process itself.
I'll just add briefly that certainly reforms are not going to be enacted or adhered to until political leaders think it's in their political interest to do so. With the reputation of Congress at a historic low, I could foresee a time when a majority in the Congress might decide it's in their political interest to try to fix the process so it yields better fiscal choices. Excuse me.
You both kind of laid out very ambitious reform agendas. Mm-hmm. But we always know that an ambitious agenda can sometimes collapse because of its own weight. So realistically, do you think it's the best idea to go big, or do you think it should be go small and incrementally? And what are your thoughts on that?
Go ahead. So, you know, I think that we've seen success in, you know, in sort of both kinds of reforms. I think the odds of going big are probably greater if the budget process changes were actually tied to some kind of a major budget policy agreement. I mean, this is what happened, for example, in 1990. So, you know, do I think that there will be a major standalone, you know, rewrite the process from the ground up budget process reform? Probably not. And I think absent, you know, some big reconciliation bill that deals with issues of budget policy, which then might have as one of its titles some kind of a budget process reform, we probably won't see going big. You know, other than that, I think you're likely to see, if there are particular issues, incremental issues that get attention, they might be attached to one piece of legislation or another.
I would agree with that. I think the progress is going to be incremental toward the kind of budget process we need. But at the same time, I think it's important, as I said, to have at the outset a vision of where you want to end up, what kind of process you want to ultimately move toward, and how the pieces fit together in some integrated fashion. So you have to have some sort of concept of where you're headed to help separate the reform ideas that are not going to be so productive from others. You said there's a laundry list of ideas out there, and I think you need some model or vision to help separate the wheat from the chaff as you go forward.
Questions from the audience?
Thank you. My name is Peter Gluck, and I'm a professor emeritus of political science and public administration, and I've done a fair amount of work in budgeting. I want to just echo the comments of the previous questioner, because I think the problem is much less a function of budget reform than it is the willingness of the current participants and even previous participants to follow the system that's already in place. So when you sign a letter that commits you to not raising taxes, or you say there are no consequences to failing to raise the debt ceiling, this suggests that no reform is going to work any better than the current system. And if you rescinded those things, then the current system would probably work pretty well.
I would just add that, you know, I've become fond of quoting Herb Stein, who was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, I believe, under President Nixon. And he said, basically, you know, there are two ways to improve budget outcomes: better people and better information. And since he didn't know how to get better people, that budget process reforms had always been focused on information. And I think if you look at a lot of the budget process reforms out there, they really are focused a lot on getting better information to the participants. My own view is that we've never had better information than we have now. And the budget outcomes procedurally or from a policy standpoint are worse. And so I agree with you that this is mostly a political problem, not a budget process problem. I think that, you know, part of the reason, frankly, even in the organization of this event, that the second panel is sort of following up and talking about politics, and that a lot of discussion in the budgeting roundtable has been around political issues, is a recognition that this is not—it's not a technical budget process problem. It is, you know, there may be some budget process problems, but they're wrapped up in this larger political problem, which has to do with you know, political polarization, I think, more than anything else. And if you can't do anything about that, then no sort of tinkering at the margins with budget process reforms is going to get you very far.
Hi, I'm Lisa Driscoll, and I am a budget technician at the Office of Management and Budget. And to speak to the point about politics, I want to get away from that and ask if you have recommendations in terms of presentation, in terms of the information you're talking about, and how we can present things that are not budget process reform per se, but the ways that we can assist in helping those decisions get made.
All right. So, you know, I think one is, you know, there are a couple of things. One that Steve alluded to, which is, I think, moving tax expenditures more sort of front and center into the process is a very important idea. I think tax expenditures are relatively invisible compared to spending, even though they do effectively the same thing. If you give somebody a benefit through the tax code or you give it through a spending program, what difference does it make? It's a whole lot more transparent at this point what happens on the spending side than what happens on the tax side. I also think that considering whether we want to expand accrual concepts, as happened under the Credit Reform Act of 1990, you know, to other parts of the budget where we may be making long-term commitments, but where the immediate cash outlay is not a very good indicator of the sort of long-term cost to the federal government, is also something worth exploring. But I think what both of those have in common is making transparent the actual cost of something when you're making a decision about
it. That's a good list. I would add to it, isolating and separating investments from other spending and tax expenditures in the budget so that there's a separate category of investments as opposed to programs where the consumption is of the benefits are generated almost immediately. That would highlight and focus attention on those kinds of spending and tax expenditures that could perhaps drive economic growth and otherwise create a stream of long-term social benefits, and they might want to get more attention. And I agree that they could be this is another opportunity perhaps to provide an accrual treatment of some sort to that set of investments. But there are a lot of issues to be dealt with, perhaps by a Budget Concepts Commission, before that's done. I think in general the President's budget would be a better document if it presented more clearly how the resources that are resource decisions were guided by choices about the major policy priorities and how best to achieve those. So I would reorganize the material in the budget around major policy objectives to the extent possible.
Rearranging those. You also talked about transparency. It puts out, what, every 2 years? Or another body bring about?
Well, I think the most important thing to do, and this is why I really like Steve and Paul's idea of portfolio budgeting, I think the most important thing to do is to make transparent what the different tools and choices are that we are making around a given policy area. I mean, right now, frankly, what gets in the way of that as much as anything is the organization of the Congress, the fact that, you know, tax ideas are under the jurisdiction of one committee, mandatory spending under another committee, appropriations under another committee. And one of the reasons that you could bring all that sort of front and center, not only in the President's budget, where it clearly could be done now, but in the budget resolution, is because these are the places where all spending and taxes are sort of being considered at the same time. So anything that would better inform those trade-offs among the different choices of policy tools in a given policy area, I think would be a step forward.
Hi, Harry Steinwitz, Center for American Progress. I wanted to go back to an earlier point, the distinction between better people and better information. I thought that was really interesting. One of the most common ideas that you hear in budget process reform is to set some sort of cap on either spending, deficits, taxes, usually mandatory spending, and then enforce that with automatic triggers. That doesn't seem to fit into either better people or better information, so I'm not sure if there's a third category, or maybe it does fit into one of those two. But where do you see those kinds of proposals fitting into the landscape?
Thank you. All right, well, so I'm gonna assert that there are two kinds of people in the world, people who believe in triggers and people who don't. And I'm going to say I'm one who doesn't. And the reason I don't is because I think they only work if they're actually a reflection of a broader consensus that we already have around doing something. That is that I actually think this is not an area where we're just sort of speculating. I think we actually have a lot of evidence, going back to Graham Rudman or even to the Budget Control Act of 2011, that simply setting targets and even imposing some apparently draconian consequence for not meeting those targets is not sufficient if the people who are having to make the decisions that would involve inflicting actual pain on actual people at that moment are not willing to do that, if instead they're willing to say, well, we didn't mean it when we set the targets. So this is back to a sort of broader theme that I didn't mention, but you've given me an opportunity to mention it now, which is that what the budget process is good at and what the budget process is not good at. And I think the budget process is not good at forcing people to make decisions that they do not want to make. It is pretty good at enforcing compliance with decisions that have already been made, but only as long as that consensus remains. That's sort of what we learned even with the Budget Enforcement Act of 1990, that the caps in the PAYGO system held as long as there was still a consensus around that. But frankly, when there became budget surpluses, that consensus began to unravel, and at that point, we just sort of went back to what happened prior to that.
I believe Trigger was Roy Rogers' horse. having agreed with virtually everything Phil just said, I would say it's partly an empirical question whether triggers and caps can be effective as a discipline, and we have a more recent test than the BEA in the Budget Control Act, and I would argue that there has been continued downward pressure on part of the budget from those caps, even though there's been some relief, and the enforcement of them potentially by sequester. So there's, I'd say that they can have their uses temporarily, but they are only sustainable as long as there's political will to adhere to an agreement that has been set in advance.
Yes, sir.
Someone else mentioned, Larry Checo, somebody else mentioned it before, but it seems to me that part of the real problem here is that how could you have a budget resolution when hundreds of guys on the Hill have already signed a pledge not to raise taxes? It's my understanding that all these folks can do is spend and raise taxes. And if they've given up half of that equation, how do you move?
I'm not even sure that's a question that needs an answer, but I do think that this is all part of this, what I would call sort of the vanishing middle. I mean, political scientists, these guys know better than I do, but there's essentially, in the Venn diagram that, is the sort of common ground between Republicans and Democrats. At this point, the Democrats have moved further to the left and the Republicans have moved further to the right. And I will say that many of the Democrats are as opposed to making changes to entitlements as the Republicans are opposed to raising taxes. They haven't signed a pledge, but it doesn't mean that they don't sort of think in that way. And I think that's the big challenge is, since the magnitude of the problem is such that we would need to do both of these things, in my opinion. We would need to both raise taxes and get control over entitlement spending. If you have one party that it refuses to do one and the other party refuses to do the other, it's very difficult to get to where you need to go, which is why there's all the attention on discretionary spending, which is not really much of the problem. That there's a lot of people that want to control discretionary spending and they don't want to talk about the two places where really you could make a big difference, which is entitlement spending and taxes.
In international diplomacy, there are techniques that allow people to reach agreement on particular actions without abandoning their commitment to their principles, such as not increasing taxes. And when there was a center in 1986, there was a tax reform that lowered rates but eliminated a lot of the tax expenditures or loopholes in the code. So I could envision perhaps something like that coupled perhaps with some increased attention to investments, long-term investments in the budget, as a basis for an agreement that would allow people to step away from their hardened positions, but not necessarily anytime soon.
I'm Rick May with the House Budget Committee, and I rise reluctantly, but when Stan Collender stands up, I usually have to stand up too. First of all, I'd like to thank Phil for the very nice comments about the Budget Committee. We worked really hard this year on budget process reform hearings, and and both Steve and Phil were part of that. I think from our experience, the example why the budget resolution didn't pass this year was because of spending, had nothing to do with taxes, because there's a lot still sort of political angst over the budget agreement that was reached last fall. So that it was really a spending problem. This isn't really a question, but it's what we discover is that many of the members, as much as we try to educate members, they either do not understand the process or they see no ramifications for not doing the process. So is there anything that we can do, the collective we can do to help educate, help the budget committee educate members and try to explain to members what the essence of the process is and that there are ramifications for not doing something?
Well, I mean, you know, in one sense, I think you did it, but I think you have to figure out how to broaden it beyond just the budget committees. I mean, you know, I would argue that the budget committee members in both the House and Senate are more educated on the budget process now than they were a year ago, just as a result of all of this sort of parade of people that came before them. But they're still only a small number, and so you know, my challenge to you would be sort of how do you expand that, you know, to better sort of educate the rank and file. And I'll stop there because it says stop right there.
We have a hard stop, and I greatly appreciate your questions this morning and the opportunity to be here with the panelists. We're going to have just a very short transition to the next panel. And moderated by Stuart Butler. Okay, I think everybody's had a good four-inning stretch, and maybe if you could take your seats, we could continue with the second panel, which will develop a lot of the themes and the discussion I know we've had in that first panel. Let me say that some people say economists always get good at arm exercise because they're always saying on the one hand and then on the other hand, and I think that certainly applies to thinking about the prospects for reform of this budget process. On the one hand, we see, as many have said, a very polarized Congress. We've seen difficulty of getting members even to talk to each other and to get to know each other. We've seen efforts in recent years to improve the process or even to use the process, as several have said, have been pretty disappointing. And so, you know, it's easy to be gloomy about the prospects for reform. On the other hand, I think there are some favorable signs, some of which have been mentioned, that may suggest that there is a possibility at some point in the future, maybe not immediately, for the reform planets to align and for us to see some changes. Now, I've been often accused of being an optimist, but I will do that this right now because I think there are certainly four signs that might suggest the possibility, at least of some time in the not too distant future, of some reform in these areas, and some have been mentioned. The first is, as I think Phil Joyce particularly focused on, we have seen within the Congress, in the budget committees in both chambers,
the leadership, in particular the majority, holding a series of hearings to look in some depth at a lot of reform ideas. There's a menu of ideas have developed from that. Now, I think in an election year, it's hard to imagine those will move forward very much, or even perhaps in the next several months in the new administration and Congress. There has been talk of ramming through some reform ideas around a budget agreement or even possibly a debt ceiling change, as has been done in the past, of course. But I think the most important feature of this is that we are seeing a process of laying out very developed ideas and proposals and pieces of legislation through these committees for public conversation and by conversation around by organizations such as ours. So I think one of the things we've seen in this, which is an important sign, is the beginning of a more public conversation around some of these ideas emanating from leaders in Congress. I think, secondly, I think there's some indication that some of the interest groups and stakeholders who are directly affected by the budget process or the lack of an effective budget process are beginning to engage or be open to a conversation about how to craft a more effective budget process. There's a kind of prisoner's dilemma aspect to this, I think, where lots of organizations feel that by pursuing their own objectives rigidly and uniquely, that they're actually going to do less well than having a more constructive conversation down the road. And one organization represented here in the audience, which I'm also involved in, an organization called Convergence, the Convergence Center for Policy Resolution, is actually bringing together a range of stakeholders directly affected by the budget and the budget process to say, is there a way we can think about a mutually beneficial changes in the budget process that would advance all our objectives? I think a third indication, again, which has been mentioned, is that if you like, the usual suspects in the research community have increased their activities and developed a number of major proposals. Bipartisan Policy Center, Brookings, of course, NAPA, and others have been doing this with much more enthusiasm, I think, in recent months. And I would say, finally, perhaps after this election, maybe the leaders of both parties and parts of the government might come to the conclusion that it is in their mutual interest to begin to indicate to the American people that the government can, in some ways, actually function as a way of beginning to kind of build confidence in a system, in our democracy, that will allow the variety of ideas of what should be done in the country to be debated and for budgets to be put together that reflect those. So perhaps there's reason for some optimism. Well, let's see if the panel agrees with me on that. I suspect some might not, on the possibilities. And to think about how would we set up conditions, a political environment, that might make it more conducive to changes in the process in the future. And we have four political scientists and veterans of the budget process and the budget. They're all members of our budgeting roundtable. And let me introduce them very briefly and let them share their views. First, Roy Myers, at the, I would call, say, the far right, which may not be ideal for him, but at the far right, who is professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And Roy has written extensively, including with a paper outside, on how lawmakers make decisions and how one might be able to craft different language and a different framework to get more effective conversations taking place. Secondly, my colleague Molly Reynolds, who's a fellow in governance studies here at Brookings, who's written extensively on the Senate, on the budget resolution, and other aspects of the political process. Third, Bill Hoagland, who is Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center, and is a 33-year veteran of federal government service, including many years on the staff of the budget of the Senate Budget Committee. And last, but by no means least, my colleague Alice Rivlin, who's pretty much had every budget job it's possible to have in Washington, as far as I can see. She's been director of the Office of Management and Budget, vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board, and the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. So let's begin with Roy. Over to you.
So thanks, Stuart. Good morning, everyone. I guess I prefer the audience's perspective. Maybe I'm on the center left, but... So I want to make two points this morning. First, that reforming the budget process will be very difficult, but it won't be impossible. And despite the current political situation, the next few years may actually see a greater chance of meaningful change than has been the case in recent years. And second, that a plausible strategy for reforming the budget process is emerging. This strategy emphasizes what Steve proposed, portfolio budgeting, which could satisfy the interests of both parties to participate in a fair fight over how the budget allocates funds. So to start with the first topic, last year I wrote a paper for the National Budgeting Roundtable that's online, and a brief version of that paper was published this spring by Brookings, is available today. And the title of that longer paper is "The Political Feasibility of Doing What is Almost Impossible." So I want to start with emphasizing what makes this situation almost impossible. Which in effect means that only minor reforms to the process can be adopted by the majority party through rules. Rather, you know, rules forced through at the beginning of a Congress without the assent of the minority. Most significant reforms will have to be bipartisan. But of course, we've just talked about how this process in American politics has become the opposite of bipartisan. We're very polarized. And there are vast differences between the two parties on most major policy questions. And that's a problem because budgeting is a process in which traditionally the parties have resolved their differences, at least partially, by making temporary compromises. And in addition, we have had traditionally a norm that annual budgets and appropriations bills have to be completed. That norm is dead. It's absolutely dead. And when Rick said he needed to educate the members, that's a good illustration of that. Frankly, from the perspective of budgeting people, it's inexcusable that bills aren't passed. And the same thing with budget resolution. And we need to come back to improving that. I know it's the feedback. Is that better? We need to get back to a situation where the norms of budgeting are really paid more attention to. In addition, we have this election year, which is completely atypical. The typical election year highlights major differences between the parties. Okay, back here. Okay. This election season has, in effect, neglected most major policy issues. And I'm going to step on a limb and say there's a likely winner, which is Secretary Clinton, and I don't think she's going to have much of a mandate from this. The only good thing I see from this election regarding issues, regarding the budget process, is that the prospective Vice President, Senator Kaine, has been an active supporter of better budgeting while Governor of Virginia and as a member of the Senate Budget Committee. He actually participated in the hearings that Senator Enzi chaired. In the House, the GOP has published not only the publications that Rick mentioned, but from the Speaker's office, six Better Way publications, which appear to me to be preparation for a substantial policy and process move next year, that with what are mostly familiar party positions, in great contrast to what Mr. Trump has proposed. And the Better Way publication on the Constitution promises, and I underline promises, to pass appropriations and regularly scheduled reauthorizations on time. Speaker Ryan also said yesterday, or maybe it was Sunday, that he would like to start with tax reform. And frankly, I think there is some potential for tax reform, but I'll be interested to see the negotiations about how like-kind exchanges of depreciated real estate property will be treated in the tax code. So my guess is that the fallout in the GOP from this presidential election will take a fair amount of time to settle. And I'll leave it to Molly to discuss how the margins of party control on each side of Capitol Hill will affect prospects for budget reform. However, I do want to agree with Steve and Phil and Stuart in their observation that the House and Senate Budget Committee hearings are a somewhat encouraging sign, although I'll say only somewhat. First, as Stan and others have said, some think that the process hearings were a cover for the unwillingness to make timely budget decisions. And second, the hearings revealed very substantial differences between the parties in how the process might be improved, particularly in the House. I think as we know, the polarization in the House is somewhat larger than it is in the Senate on budget processes, on many other issues. But on the good side, I think these hearings also showed that many legislators are frustrated and embarrassed by the congressional budget dysfunction, and that's a necessary step for reform. Shortly after the Congressional Budget Act was passed, Thomas Dodd, a political scientist, wrote a number of very good articles about how Congress reforms itself. And he argued that in the case of the Congressional Budget Act, one reason why it's passed is that members decided that their own electoral prospects were harmed by serving in a dysfunctional body. Now, they can get away with that for a while by running against their colleagues and running against the institution. Dick Fenno wrote a famous article for Time magazine saying, you know, basically asking if Congress is the broken branch of government, why do we love our members of Congress so much? And the answer was that they were all running against Congress. But, eventually you can't get away with that, and I think we've reached that point. Another positive result from the Senate hearings is that I think there was some bipartisan recognition of the desirability of making at least some minor changes, such as limiting the voter Amish raid that Phil mentioned. So to get to the second point, what is the plausible strategy for reform? I think the Budget Control Act of 2011 was a massive mistake in trying to create a grand bargain for debt reduction. I don't think that it was possible to force one through so-called action forcing mechanisms. And actually, to bolster Phil's point, I wrote an article called The Implosion of the Federal Budget Process that was published in Public Budgeting and Finance about that very issue. There really wasn't enough trust between the parties to enable compromises over the big differences that they have, including the tax pledge and Social Security expansion. So instead, we focus on the backup provisions of that act for discretionary spending, which create stupid policies, and it had to be revised in 2013 and 2015. It'll have to be revised again next year. So I think the better alternative is to drop the obsession with a grand bargain and instead try and figure out how we can improve how the budget process allows government officials to allocate the government's limited funds. And I think the portfolio approach is the right first step on this alternative path. After all, you only can get fiscal discipline for the whole of government if you have a reasonable way of allocating funds for each part of the budget. Senator Enzi suggested that a subcommittee of the Budget Committee could be tasked with reviewing a sector of the budget, including spending through the tax code. That's a Republican saying, looking at spending through the tax code, which would allow, quote, reducing wasteful spending and focusing attention on measurable results. And by the way, no legislation is needed for this. The Budget Committee could appoint subcommittees and could use reconciliation, and that could be tied to the Government Performance Results Act, Modernization Act, that Steve mentioned, given the strategic plans that are supposed to be coming out of the agencies over the next couple of years. In some contrast, the staff paper from the House Budget Committee majority warned against this approach as potentially promoting a, quote, tax and spend, end quote, result. And I think that's an unfortunate conclusion, although I understand that it's responsive to the House Freedom Caucus's opinions. So I think the real challenge that we face is how to convince each side that they'll get enough out of the portfolio approach to make its risks worthwhile. In the Brookings brief that was handed out here, I mentioned two framing approaches for trying to make that argument. First is, I think far too often we talk about budget process reforms as the equivalent of terribly tasting medicine that must be swallowed in hopes of avoiding certain and immediate death or imminent death. And that negativity is really not credible. Instead, I think we need to be much more positive, to switch from the medicinal metaphor to replace the sticks of budget process reform discipline with the carrots of how can we make the United States a better place by devising a way to allocate funds that will make programs more effective. Second, the portfolio approach will enable each side to have a say in a fair fight over how spending and tax policies in each sector of the budget should be improved. To quote two sentences from my brief, deficit hawks should especially value this level playing field effect because it would encourage more competition between claimants for funds. Competition's a good thing. Most Americans believe in that. And those who want to expand spending on specific programs could claim that reallocating funds from ineffective and low-priority programs would produce opportunity benefits. Again, switching from the opportunity cost negative idea to the opportunity benefits of making America, well, better again. To be clear, and I suppose controversial to some extent, I view this approach as the minimal needed reform. I agree with Phil's suggestion that over the long run, Congress needs to make larger reforms to its duplicative and inefficient committee structure and legislative procedures. Alice said that many years ago, and she was right then. Congressman Lipinski and LaHood have sponsored a bill that would create a new committee on the organization of Congress, which I hope will be considered seriously next year. For now, though, I think we should try the baby step of portfolio budgeting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. Thank you all for coming. What I'd like to do today is two things, and the first is to ask if advocates of budget process reform in Congress have any hope of building momentum for any sort of process changes, what questions do we need to answer? And here I'd like to begin by reminding us that fundamentally legislative processes and procedures, whether they're in the budget process or anywhere else, are about allocating power within the chamber, and changing them changes who has the power. So first question is, can you convince individual members that it's in their political interests to support process reforms? And Roy touched on this a little bit. But specifically, would budget process changes reallocate power in a way that makes it easier for individual members to achieve their individual goals, especially re-election? So let's think, for example, about biennial budgeting, which was mentioned briefly on the first panel. So is there something about setting budget aggregates every 2 years that would make individual members of Congress better off? Maybe, if it means that appropriations bills were actually more likely to be considered. I think individual members would consider that a worthy goal. Individual appropriations bills give members a chance to offer amendments, take positions on particular issues. To some degree, assumes that the obstacle to finishing the appropriations process is not enough time. So you can take that or leave that. On the same logic, take changing consideration of the budget resolution, which as Stuart mentioned is something that I've done some work on. So members claim to hate, especially in the Senate, the current consideration of the budget resolution, the Votorama. But there's a solid argument to be made that the Votorama represents one of the few chances that members have in the Senate now to actually offer amendments in a way that's unstructured by the party leadership. And so would you actually be able to convince members to give up their chance to offer amendments? So second question, what are the consequences for budget process reform for existing power bases in Congress? And so I think one of the biggest lessons that we should take away from the passage of the Congressional Budget Act in 1974 was that that act did little to threaten existing power bases in Congress and simply imposed a new structure on top of the existing set of appropriations, authorizing, and revenue committees. So where are the power bases today? There's some sense that the power of authorizing committees has declined in Congress. Is there a way to convince members, particularly authorizers, that moving to some different parts of the budget process would reinvigorate the role of committees more broadly? I could imagine portfolio budgeting, if cast to reinvigorate some power for authorizers, would get some traction here. To think about one of the things Phil mentioned earlier, if we were to try and strengthen the budget committee, where would that power come at the expense of? Would it come at the expense of someone else? And then the third question is, what's the relationship between process and outcomes? Just like we can't isolate the process from the politics, we can't isolate the process from the outcomes that the process produces. So any ability to build momentum for process changes must account for the fact that members, especially rank and file members, without expertise in how the process works, are likely concerned that a coalition that's pushing a set of changes to the process would be doing so because they want to produce a set of policies that a new process would be easier to achieve. And members aren't wrong to be worried about this. There are other changes to congressional rules and procedure that have been motivated by similar political concerns rather than by principled motivations about how to make the institution work better. And this is a particular challenge if a set of process changes in the budget process or otherwise are being largely advocated by members of one party. So the second thing I want to do is, shockingly to no one, we're about to have an election. And what could this mean for the prospects of building a budget reform coalition? So in the House, again, shocking to no one, we're in the midst of a period of pretty significant intra-party conflict among elite Republicans, especially within the House Republican Party. There are reasons to think that the House Republican Conference may get smaller in the next Congress. There's a lot of hand-wringing right now in the political press about how many seats Democrats are likely to pick up in the House. I'm not going to forecast that here. If I could do that well, this would not be the job I should have. But what's important to note is that if Democrats do pick up seats, they're likely to be in swing districts. And as a result, they're likely to replace the kinds of members who have been, in the past several Congresses, more likely to go along with big, sweeping budget deals that are negotiated by Republican and Democratic leaders. The House Freedom Caucus and other allied members on the more conservative wing of the House Republican Party may increase in both size and influence in the next Congress. So there's some evidence that the Freedom Caucus has recruited candidates or been involved in helping to recruit candidates in some open Republican seats, recruit candidates who are more likely to be allied with them. We saw this happen in the seat that used to be John Boehner's in Ohio. And then in influence, so if the Republican conference is overall is smaller and the Freedom Caucus and its allies make up a larger share of that conference, and we may see them be more influential. So in the Senate, whichever party wins the Senate, and that's still quite unclear, is likely to have a small majority. So we're going to be dealing with a small either Republican or a Democratic majority in the Senate. And so what this means is that if we do have a stronger sort of conservative wing of the House Republican Conference, that means a more influential group in the conference who may see budget process reform as being more closely associated with a particular set of policy outcomes. And that opens up sort of two possibilities as I see it. One is that a conservative wing of the House Republican Party pushes for a set of budget process reforms that reflect a set of their policy priorities, which would be extremely difficult to move in the Senate, even if Republicans controlled the Senate, unless you go the reconciliation route, which would have its own challenges, and just wouldn't make a lot of sense if we have a Democratic president who'd be likely to veto something. A more bipartisan approach that would basically write off or jettison some more conservative House votes in favor of Democratic votes would be, I think, a suboptimal place for the Speaker of the House to alienate the right end of his caucus. If we think there's some sort of maximum tolerance for taking votes in the House that some Republicans oppose, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to use one of those on budget process reform. So finally, what about this notion that's been, I think, mentioned in the press and that was mentioned on the first panel, that the place where we might see budget process reform in a new Congress is as a part of a broader budget agreement, especially something that's considered must pass, like a new two-year budget agreement or a debt ceiling measure. So in principle, this makes some sense. To the extent that Congress has a negotiating strength anymore, it's the ability to log roll things together. In the current partisan environment, large omnibus measures with carefully constructed log rolls have been an important tool for leaders to get things accomplished without having to take repeated votes, which is especially hard in a polarized system where coalition building is a challenge. If we're talking about some of the smaller scale changes that we've discussed, there's some evidence from the political science literature that those kinds of measures are more likely to make it into big omnibus bills. Divided government, which we are increasingly likely to see in the new year, also increases the likelihood of omnibus legislating. The catch here is that you want something that's important enough to have supporters who are willing to fight for its inclusion in an omnibus, but not something that's so important to opponents that if it's in there, it would have the potential to derail a deal. And I'll stop there.
Good morning, everyone. Let me, before I begin, give a shout out to Dan Blair and the service that he's given to NAPA. Maybe some of you might know that he is stepping down as the leader of that organization. I only know that because I was asked to serve on a search committee to replace him, and we're working on it. But let me begin with a simple fact that it's been already discussed briefly here, is when the governing process fails to function, or more importantly, when it's perceived by a majority of the electorate to have failed, I think reform is not only necessary but essential to maintain our democratic process. And I think the fact that the House and Senate have concluded their business for the last 18 years in a lame duck session following an election, and we're going to have a 19th year now, is clearly an indication that the process is not functioning correctly. And that's not to mention what has already been mentioned a few times here. Only once in the last 20 years have all appropriation bills been completed on time. And only once in the last 7 years have we had a conference agreement on a budget resolution. Further, I've always used as a mantra that governing is budgeting, and budgeting is governing. I now say if you cannot govern, you cannot budget. And as Stuart made an observation at the outset today, we know that from long-running surveys, research, that the public's confidence in Congress is at its lowest point ever since such research has been conducted. And now when confidence in the Congress is at these very historically low levels, it makes it even harder to advance positive reforms, since the level of cynicism and skepticism only feeds on itself, and the public's perception is that the reforms are not really reforms at all, but changes to benefit those, quote, who are in power. So it's a vicious circle. And I think it should be clear by now for everyone from the presidential campaign that there is a very large swath of the American public out there who believe that the process has failed them. And quite frankly, for many middle America, it has failed. So whether you support a Democrat or Republican candidates in a few weeks, I think the key to the purpose of this panel, overcoming political, the key is to be able to restore confidence in the government, and it's crucial if we're going to overcome those obstacles to reforming the federal budget. But and I'll come back to that in just a minute. But as it relates to the process itself, first, I think as Phil said it earlier, I think the basic structure of the 74 Congressional Budget Impoundment Control Act was sound. I argue that in many ways the act was not meant to necessarily force a particular policy outcome, but rather to put in place a very straightforward accounting system for the Congress so that the right hand knew what the left hand was doing. And it was a system that created a process to set broad parameters for spending and revenues at the beginning of the session, and so that once they had finished their session, they were not shocked by what the outcomes they had produced. In many ways, the process was agnostic from my perspective as to whether it would produce surpluses or deficits, but at least if they carried out the process, they would know they were producing surpluses or deficits ahead of time, and a fiscal blueprint would be set, something that did not exist before the 74 Act. That process changed, however, I would argue, in the early Reagan years with the use of the so-called reconciliation process more broadly. But most importantly, and with the reforms included later in the passage of the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act in 1985. And those reforms, many of which we are still living with in the aftermath today, set very fixed policy goals. At that particular time, a balanced budget at a fixed date. And I would argue that those changes fundamentally altered the process from basically being a policy-neutral process, an accounting tool, to one that attempted to force outcomes to a specific fiscal outcome. Now, I've been a participant in some of these reform proposals over the years. Some of you in the audience I know might also say that they were complete failures and I was responsible for that. Fine. So any advice I give today probably should be looked at probably with some skepticism. But I have come to the conclusion that we can talk all we want about changing our maybe to a biennial budgeting or appropriation cycle or recreating the Commission on Budget concepts, both changes, by the way, which I support. We can talk about changing it from a concurrent resolution to a joint resolution, eliminating Voterama. Quite just as a sidebar there, I've been through quite a few Voteramas, and I've always concluded that at least it was a safety valve and they were doing less damage with voting on amendments that didn't mean anything than on votes amendments that really did. So let me come back to from the scriptures. Physician, heal thyself. Congress, the governing body, needs to heal thyself before it's too late. And there is no shortage of ideas. We've already heard a lot of them, of how Congress might heal itself from academia, from media, my organization, the Bipartisan Policy Center, to NAPA, to Brookings, Congressional Institute. Clearly, we are not short of ideas, and ideas, many of them that have merit, I would agree. We cultivate ideas quite well. The problem is in growing them and harvesting them. And so I have come to the further conclusion that the time has arrived, as it did when we reached similar low points in the past, the 1921 Budget and Accounting Act, the 1946-70 Legislative Reorganization Act, and yes, the 74 Budget Act. It's come time to look at the entire legislative process, not just the budget process. And here there's some good news, and Roy's already mentioned a little bit of it. On September 28th, right before they went out and departed for the election, a bipartisan House concurrent resolution was introduced, sponsored by Republican Congressman Darren LaHood and Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski, both of Illinois, to take this reform discussion to a new level. And the resolution, H. Con. Res. 169, would establish a bipartisan joint committee on the organization of Congress. It currently has 38 original co-sponsors on its introduction, and that was as they were going out the door. So I would hope that when they come back after the election, that more will sign up on in the post-election period. We have had three similar joint committees over the past 100 years, the last being created almost a quarter of a century ago. This particular joint committee would be comprised of 24 members, 12 each from the House and Senate, evenly divided between the parties. The resolution does not set a specific agenda. It would merely serve as the platform and the mechanism where all ideas, those that are discussed here, including those from in the public that could debate, and it would result in some final recommendations. Sadly, my old stomping ground, a companion resolution has not been introduced in the Senate. And, of course, with only 12 scheduled legislative days when they return in the lame duck, no enactment of any of this is going to take place. But regardless of who controls the Senate or House in the 115th Congress, I would hope that the bipartisan nature of a resolution could be considered and adopted, that it would pave the – that if this was adopted, would pave the way for consensus on budget reform recommendations and, most importantly, begin this very arduous and slow task of trying to restore some of the public's confidence in their government. Reforms will not be enacted just by our good ideas here in think tanks or in academia or from advocacy work to promote these ideas. Congress has to do this themselves, and they have to show the public they can heal themselves to restore that lost trust.
I want to start by reassuring Stan Collender and anyone else that appearing on a budget process panel does not mean that I think that process is the problem or what we primarily need to fix. As many have said eloquently, we're witnessing a breakdown in our political process, in our governing process, which we have to heal if we're going to be a great nation. I don't think the problem is primarily in polarization of views, although that contributes. It is primarily in losing the idea, which is fundamental to our Constitution, that we need to have a process of compromise, that governing is compromise, and never is it more evident than in any budget making. Budget making is essentially compromising and allocating scarce resources among priorities in a compromise way. That said, we all agree that the budget process is broken. It hasn't been used, as Bill pointed out, or completed on time in a very long time. And even when it was working, it had major flaws. I think there are three. It's too complicated for most members to understand, too many layers that chew up too much time for Congress and the executive. That's not the fault of the 74 Act. It was already there, and the 74 Act was layered on top of an already complicated process. Second, it leaves out the most important parts of the budget. It left out entitlements and tax expenditures, which were already growing disproportionately in 1974 and have grown much more disproportionately since then, so that the focus, as everybody has said, is on a declining portion of the budget, and that doesn't make sense. And third, it never involved the president and the leadership of Congress in a clear way that allowed them to resolve their major differences and work together on the big decisions and then move things along. So while going back to regular order sounds nice, and it would certainly be better than doing nothing at all, regular order wasn't doing its job even when we were sort of following it. Now, it's tempting, because we're scholars of the budget process, in this situation to say, let's blow it all up and start over. Here's this neat plan of how things ought to be done. And we've heard a lot of good ideas today, and the people in this room could design a more elegant process that would have the right incentives for both speed and fiscal rectitude built in. I think such a process would be inclusive. It would include all spending, including tax expenditures and revenues. It would have a longer time horizon, and it would have the leadership heavily involved. And it's hard to do that without restructuring the committee structure first. And I was glad to hear Phil Joyce alluding to an idea that I first promulgated in before the 74 Act. Most of you weren't alive then, of restructuring the committee process. But as we all know, it isn't just the budget process that's broken. The whole decision process is broken, and especially if if we turn out to have the political situation, divided government, and the situation in the House and Senate that Molly describes, I would not advise anybody, either the new president or the new leadership of Congress, to start with trying to reform the budget process. They have to start with the minimum necessary things they can agree on to keep the government running, and then find ways to explore and act on the common ground that I believe they do have in the policy area that can allow them to show some things can function and, as Bill said, restore some confidence in government. So I would say maybe even start with an omnibus appropriation proposal for 2 years that would get the government funded, and you'd have to work out the compromise on how to do that, but just do it and get that out of the way. And then start working on some of the policy proposals on which I think they might find common ground. One of them would be a major infrastructure bill. And maybe some other investments in research, maybe early childhood. Another would be corporate tax reform. Another, believe it or not, I think would be Social Security reform. If you had done those major things in the first Congress, you would have done a lot. Then you could move on to some of the more controversial pieces, individual tax reform being one of them, and Medicare reform being another. I don't regard those as urgent or as feasible as the others, which is why I put them up front. But I think Bill is absolutely right. The task is for the two branches to work together as well as they can to restore confidence that our government is functioning, can do something, isn't totally broken. I'd first get the appropriations out of the way for a couple of years and then say, what can we do together that will show that government functions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have about 30 minutes for question and conversation. But maybe I could just ask initially, I heard as when we heard the panelists, I think the argument, particularly by Roy and by Alice, that we should get away from the idea that we're going to get change in some big way as a result of dealing with a big crisis, the sort of the crisis view that instead sort of move much more towards an incremental approach. It's a little bit, I think, like the theories of dealing with achieving peace in the Middle East. Probably rather than start with the future of Jerusalem, let's start with how we pick the garbage up in different parts of the areas. Is that a general consensus? I mean, Molly and Bill in particular, do you share that view?
I think that to the extent that there's any real possibility for getting anything done, yes, what's feasible is smaller rather than larger.
I concur that it's incremental changes are the way the process will be reformed. I guess maybe my hesitancy in answering this question is I look at that Joint Committee on the Reorganization of Congress as being something that's bigger than incremental, because you're talking about changing the structure of the Congress, you're changing the structure of the committees and their responsibilities, but at least that, to the extent you're setting the Reform Commission or the Joint Committee up, you're at least making an incremental step in that direction.
I would concur with that, but in part because I think getting people thinking about the structure of Congress is a really good thing, and it's going to take such a committee quite a long time before it brings anything to the floor. So I think this is not an incompatible notion.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have two microphones available for questions. Nobody provoked? Oh, yes, here we go. And please announce your name.
Romina Baccia with the Heritage Foundation. I wanted to talk about the point that Stuart just made in referring to the fact that the programs that are driving most of the increase in spending projected over the next 10, 20, 30 years also happen to be the most popular programs politically. Does that not mean then that in order to bring about any political motivation to do anything about those, you need a lot of political cover for those lawmakers who are going to tackle those programs, because any changes that you make, there will be losers. Now, there will be winners as well, because the status quo is not particularly suitable for many of the populations programs like Social Security and Medicaid are supposed to serve. But I do wonder if you need some sort of a crisis, and it could be combined with an economic crisis or fiscal crisis, to bring about the political cover where lawmakers can say, we need to make these changes. We knew all along these programs were unsustainable, but we had no political incentive to reform them. But now there's a natural limit, whether that be the deficit is out of control, borrowing costs spiral, we actually have to do something at this point. I just don't know that we're going to tackle these challenges with incremental changes, because there's no reason to.
Okay, I'll start. I think I'll put a specific policy in your category, which is health policy, and Alice and Bill know much more about this than I do. But it seems to me that the problem that we face, which is excessive cost and excessive cost growth, is also an opportunity, and that we need to think about how we structure the budget process to make it more likely we'll take advantage of the opportunities for incremental changes in the sector year after year after year to make the quality of health better and reduce the cost of both the private and public sector. Endless votes on repeal and replace is not the way to do it. Nor is the current structure that conducive to making the kind of intelligent changes in the health sector that we need. For example, we have a budget scorekeeping rule about so-called CHIMPS, changes in mandatory spending, which is an understandable way of trying to control gimmicks, but also prevents reasonable trade-offs between investments in the discretionary side of health spending, such as with HRSA, that might reduce Medicaid outlays over the long run. One of the advantages of the portfolio approach, whether it's done in an incremental way like we've suggested, or the more ambitious way that Bill and I support of committee reorganization, where we, for example, have a health committee, is that we'd be focusing on the policy issues as well as on budgetary costs and scoring. Right now, the process just excessively focuses on annual scoring and not enough on the big picture.
Two things. One, if what is going on in our political world right now is not a crisis, I don't know what is. I think we have a crisis of government, of governing, though it may not be an economic crisis, that should be sufficient to propel the newly elected leaders to say, how can we get governing back on track? And I think that is trying some confidence-building measures. But as to health, the reason I didn't put health first is I think it's too difficult. I'd put Social Security first and the entitlement reform, because I don't think it's that hard. And I think you could find some common ground there. And the thing about health is, A, it's really difficult if you're going to make major changes, but B, you don't need to. A lot of the reforms that would make our system of delivering health care more cost-effective are actually happening. And we've had very small increases in health care costs, despite the rigmarole about premium increases in the ACA. They're very small. We've had very small increases in total health spending recently. So we're not in a crisis there, and we're on the track to some solutions.
Can I just quickly respond? Sure. That two things. I agree with Alice that healthcare costs have come down on a per capita basis. The difficulty is the capitas are going up at the same time, and that's creating a spending issue. But to your question, I think also, and I agree with Alice, on Social Security, we have a crisis coming, And it is 2034 in terms of that 22% reduction from what people think. So I think the time to address Social Security is now. We've always talked about it.
Second, and those people aren't our grandchildren. They're middle-aged workers.
There's people in this room here.
That's right.
And the other point I would simply make, this goes back to one of the earlier discussions about the presentation. I think we've got a problem with our, quote, baselines, because it's always a cut. We're not talking about cuts. We're talking about slowing the rate of growth, and that's different. And somehow that part of it. I remember when Secretary Panetta was leaving his job, he said there are two ways to address these budget issues. One is through crisis, and the second is through leadership. And I think the it's back to the big picture here. Unless we have some bipartisan leadership, not only out of Congress, but out of the executive branch too, we're not going to solve this problem. And when you have bipartisanship, then we all walk the gangplank together and we all take responsibility. It's not just Republican or Democrat.
I just have one thing to add, which I think that you're absolutely right to hit on the importance of thinking about the political incentives of the individual members who you would need to get on board to build a coalition here. I think the question is, even in something that we might consider a crisis, are those political incentives there for all of the members that we would need them to be? And I just don't know if that's true.
You know, I wondered how long it would take to get to baselines as an issue. We got through 93 minutes. I think that's a pretty good record, actually. But anyway, there's a question over here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is the second time I'm asking a question, but I've asked this question numerous times before, and I've never really gotten a satisfactory answer. Does the Washington establishment really understand not how only angry and frustrated the people are, but many have been mortally wounded financially, and it's going to take them generations, if at all, to recoup what they've lost in the last Great Recession? Is there any wonder why we have Donald Trump? I hate to say it, I don't know who's in favor of him here, but, you know, and to some degree, Bernie Sanders. I just want a thermometer or a barometer as, does the Washington establishment understand this, or are we always going to talk about policy and all these 30,000 feet issues? Thank you.
Anyone want to try that one?
There's a lot of anger out there, and the Washington establishment, I think the national establishment, bears a lot of the blame, in my opinion, first and foremost for allowing the financial crisis of 2008 to happen. That was unnecessary. The record since then has been of recovery, but not repairing the basic damage. That said, the question of how government responds once you have a set of elected leaders, and I think it's going to be divided government, and it's going to be coming into a very polarized and angry situation, but it's got to focus on policy, and that's what we're talking about.
I just will say that, number one, there is a lot of anger, I know, and firsthand from coming from the Midwest. And if some of you haven't read this little book called The Hillbilly Elegy, read it, because I think it communicates pretty quickly that there is some real anger out there. But it's the same, and I told somebody this earlier this morning, I mean, when you come to Washington from the Midwest, you say, this is not home, I'm always going back to the farm, and I've been here for more than 40 years now, so I guess can call this home. But my problem is that I came here with the idea that policy mattered and would help make things better for people. And so while we obviously have screwed up policy, I wonder, at least for a large chunk of people out there today, I wonder what if my time here has been in vain for 40 years. What have we brought except conferences and talk about these things? So there is a real, I get your message, if nothing else. And I don't know, but I still have faith in the system that it can correct itself, and policy matters for those people out there.
Well, I wonder, Bill, just bearing in mind what the question said, this is something which is not unique to one side of the political spectrum. You mentioned here both Trump and Bernie Sanders. It's a bipartisan kind of feeling, a deep feeling of an anger around the country that Washington isn't functioning. I mean, do you think that, I mean, you mentioned the idea of a joint committee and so on. Is the time right, and are you seeing the kind of agreement across the aisle that we, in the sense of we in the Washington community, that at least have, not myself, but at least have control of the government in some way, have a mutual interest, no matter what their view of what policy should be enacted or even the size of government, they have a mutual interest in beginning to take some steps, albeit maybe incrementally and visibly, probably with an idea added with an idea that you've raised often, which is that we ought to have a pay requirement, that a pay reduction on members of Congress if they don't reach agreements and they don't keep the timelines, which I think would be very popular around the country and is. Is the time right for this kind of bipartisan approach?
But by the way, that's Bill Hoagland. I'm not being paid by the Congress, so whenever I made that proposal, it usually gets shot down anyway, particularly by members of Congress.
Right.
So I don't think there's any chance there. But no, I think this election has heightened the issue in the American public, and I think the message will come through. Whether that will lead to something that will start to address these concerns, who knows? But I do think this, we're at a tipping point here, and I think elected officials are taking notice. Let's put it that way.
Other questions?
Can I just say one thing?
Sorry.
Two things. First, Bill, I think you should look in the mirror and say I've done good over your career, number one. there are a number of reasons why people are angry. I think some of them are justified based on their economic status, and others are really representation of the worst parts of our history. And it being reflected by some of the stances taken by the Republican presidential candidate. But, to get to the political science research, there's a fair amount of evidence that a lot of Americans dislike government because they dislike observing conflict. And some of that, they don't like watching debates. They don't like seeing disagreements and clashing values. And to some extent, that's unfortunate. But the negative reaction is magnified when the Washington establishment, as you put it, doesn't see a need to try and move away from responding to the immediate political incentives they face to try and build confidence, as Stuart made the analogy. What we need in the budget process is a joint effort across the party divide to try and reestablish some basic norms, as Alice said, of compromise, of paying attention to the information that Phil says is out there, which is relatively high quality, particularly on the cost side of the budget, maybe a little less on the benefit side. So I think there's actually a lot of relevance of this topic to the general problem that you described. We need to think about a way in which we can use the budget process and other processes that Congress uses to set out policy differences and then try and resolve them in a much more intelligent and patriotic way.
I just have one thing to build on Roy's point, which is that first to sort of say that I think there's some pretty good evidence that this election is about more than just voter anger. The story is much more complicated than that. But to also to say that it's when members of Congress come to Washington and sort of fight out the fights that they have about policy, to the extent that they do that, they're not operating in a vacuum. They're responding to the incentives that the voters who sent them to Washington sent them here to do. And so if they're behaving the way that they are, we have to ask why are they doing that, and what are the incentives that they're responding mm-hmm. to.
Can I just add one last comment on my part, because this bothers me a lot, and that is that the establishment, and I would imagine most of the people in this room are the establishment inside the Beltway, all that, is not saying, we're not saying that the our democratic election process is rigged. Somebody outside the establishment is saying that, and that's undercutting our ability to govern.
Other questions?
Yes,
Dan Crippen.
A couple of observations.
Mention your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Dan Crippen, as I've described to many of you, government has been. one of my former roles was executive director of the CBO. A couple of quick observations for whatever they're worth. One, first, I agree with much of what has been said and recommended for changes in the budget process. It's not working now, and we ought to try something to make it work better. But for much of its history, the budget process has proven to be more a speed bump than a roadblock. It reminds people of what they are doing and tries to inform them of that, but certainly doesn't prevent some of the things that we've seen in the past of major entitlement additions, major tax cuts, those kinds of things, even though there were violations of both the budget process and rules. First observation, if you will, is that, as Bill knows better than I, the core of the Budget Act is really a suspension, change, or waiver of Senate rules. We've talked a lot today about House, but it's really the Senate rules that form the changes that form the core of the Budget Act, because it restricts filibuster, it requires germaneness, now with the Byrd rule, there are lots of other restrictions. So, in effect, it's the Senate that you're talking about changing much of the. The House has the convenience, of course, of a Rules Committee, in which they can waive many of the rules that are required by the Budget Act or other things. Second observation is that while congressional reform is a great thing for lots of reasons, we've tried it, as Bill said, I think, several times in the past and made a little progress. The Senate had a committee early on, Senate-only committee early on in the 80s, and it made some changes about how things are done, how defense budgets are considered, those kinds of things. But in the main, the House and the Senate both have single committees that are responsible for much of the entitlement programs we've been talking about. The Senate Finance Committee has complete jurisdiction over taxes, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So the various things we've talked about needing in terms of a policy context are in a single committee. I don't know how reorganization would change that, but it doesn't take reorganization in sense to get the committee process at least to work. And of course, as many of you know, the House Ways and Means Committee has Social Security, taxes, and Medicare. So there are too many of the things we've talked about are single committees. So I think what I'm suggesting is the budget process reforms are very good. We need to do them, better information, if we could, better people. But they won't be ultimately productive or producing better outcomes, and that we could do some things now by looking at single committees and how to perhaps get them to do activity.
Any reactions? You agree? Everybody agree? Okay. Any other questions?
The only thing I would say is that your characterization of the Budget Act as being a lot about sort of reallocating power in the Senate, I think is completely consistent with sort of where I started my comments, which is saying that when we think about any of these changes, the question that we need to ask is who has power now and who would get or lose power in under the changes.
I have a question at the back.
Hi, Paul. Paul Posner. Sorry. George Mason University, and collaborator and co-conspirator with some of these people. And I totally endorse my budget act, the reform impulse. But I also think Molly has a point that somehow we have to have a more finer grained sense of the political feasibility. So in a sense, when you look at the politics of budgeting in this country in the past 50 years, it's been an ad hoc coalition. It's required some forms of bipartisan or cross-partisan collaboration, not with all the parties. And we see that in other countries, Netherlands and the like, that coalitions form. And in Europe, they're very strongly bound to a parliamentary system by incentives. If the coalition fails, the government goes out of business as a vote of no confidence. And you have to start over. That's a huge penalty. In our system, that doesn't seem to be a penalty. The failure to abide by an ad hoc coalition of the budget seems to have no cost. In fact, it has benefits.
potentially, because factions can exploit that and campaign against the coalition and against the reigning economic ideas of the day and possibly strengthen themselves in the polls. And I think somehow we have to understand when we think about this election, not just the implications for the Congress, but the implications for our party system. What kind of Republican Party in particular is going to emerge? Is the politics of coalition building still going to be perceived as politically advantageous to enough House and Senate members to recognize, to enable them to live with some of the compromise? Or is there still going to be a premium, have we seen the past 6 years, of holding out and not valuing government action, but rather valuing the gains you get from being a holdout and living to have a better political result, ultimately, to changing the mathematics of that coalition? So I do think we have to recognize, sadly to some of us, that we're really kind of a victim of not dead economists, but, you know, political forces that we don't really understand that well. And I think what's going to happen inside the Republican Party after November 8th is going to be critical to whether any of these governance reforms are going to happen.
Any thoughts on that?
I'll just say this, Paul, which is that historically, when we've seen sort of intra-party divisions emerge, particularly in the House, one response to that has been to decentralize power away from the Speaker. And so one thing to sort of look forward to is to see if that is a response, or if the kind of system that we're in now makes that response no longer an effective way to manage divisions within the House majority party. Because at the end of the day, our congressional institutions have evolved and are designed for a two-party system and not for a party system that doesn't deal well with division within its ranks.
Any other questions? Yes. Dan, we'll make this last one.
I don't mean to throw a rock in the punch bowl.
Oh, well, don't.
What about we've talked a little bit about the appropriations process, and portfolio budgeting would have a tremendous impact upon the Appropriations Committee and its jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Where do the appropriators fit into this mix of budget process reforms? In the past, there's been at best a reluctance on their part to embrace biennial budgeting. And for the last few years, they've been the budget process. So what are your thoughts on that?
Bill, do you want to start on that?
I agree with you. I've had clashes with my appropriation colleagues over the years, and whenever I talk about biennial budgeting, the clashes get even worse. And quite frankly, they'll tell me that, Bill, we're the only ones that are actually governing. We're doing the oversight. We're doing the appropriations. And to some extent, that's absolutely correct. But that's not the way the process is supposed to work. That's why we have authorizing committees. So it'll never happen. Come on, guys. It'll never happen. We're not going to collapse the authorizings and the appropriation committees together. That's not going to happen. But we can strengthen the authorization process to give more oversight on the appropriation process. I don't know what the latest figures were, $350 billion worth of expenditures are appropriated that are not authorized. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. So I do think that your idea, Steve and Paul's idea about some portfolio budgeting could strengthen the authorizing budgeting process and impact the appropriation process. I have no qualms with moving forward with some form of changing that structure. Last comment I'll make is that I also do think, said on here early, I do think you need to strengthen the budget committee structure too, and that if that brings putting back the chairman and by the way, when the Budget Act was set up, some of those original members were chairman of the finance, chairman of appropriation, chairman of the defense committee, and that we've lost that, and you need to get back to that structure, I think, to give the budget committees more of a leadership type role.
Yeah. Okay, I want to question or challenge your assertion that the appropriations are the budget process the last couple of years. Yes, there's an agreement in 2015 adjusting the caps. Look at the status of appropriations bills page. Where are the 302Bs? in one house. Why is it so difficult to get the motion to proceed to move an appropriations bill in the other house? I mean, basically, the appropriations process is fundamentally broken. And in addition, it doesn't cover the massive amount of spending on the mandatory side or tax preferences. The appropriators do play important roles now, and any revised process will need to have careful, smart, both on substance and politics, clerks who oversee the agencies. But that can be done through a combined authorizations and appropriations process as well. The way we have it set up now is rather absurd in a number of respects. Just look at the highway bill, surface transportation. We can't get an agreement on raising taxes because of the pledge. We have VA in one category, outlays another. It's nonsensical. Anyone who pays attention to some of the, we can do the same thing with Pell Grants. Some people here from CBO who spend endless years dealing with arcane scoring issues to follow the rules that make little sense. So if we're really going to pay attention to the fine details of the budget process, you learn more and more the need for more comprehensive reform, acknowledging that, yes, it's difficult to do, but let's at least try and make some baby steps in the direction of you know, pretending that the appropriations process is the only thing that matters.
Well, we seem to have resolved this issue slightly ahead of schedule and below budget. So I think it's a real example to the country that Washington can function in dealing with these issues. So I want to thank the panel very much. And let me also thank Dan Blair and the National Academy of Public Administration. And enjoy the election. Thank you very much.